The gospel text for today comes from the 25th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew has set up his book so that there are five different speeches by Jesus, collections of material. He puts him on a mountain and thus kind of describes him in a way as a new Moses who comes with the authority of God to reveal God's truth to all people. And the very last part of the very last collection of teachings is this one. Listen. Jesus says, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations shall be gathered before him. And he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, 'Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me.' Then the righteous will answer him, 'Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?' And the king will answer them, 'Truly I tell you, just as you did it for one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me.' Then he will say to those at his left hand, 'You that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me, naked, and you did not give me clothing, sick and in prison, and you did not visit me.' Then they also will answer, 'Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison, and did not take care of you?' Then he will answer them, 'Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me.' And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. In the opening weeks of the Second World War, the poet W.H. Auden created a new poem. He titled it September 1st, 1939. That's the date when Germany initiated the war by invading Poland. That poem is long enough that I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. I'll let you find it later today if you wish. But I'll give you a little bit of it and then the next to last stanza. It's a poem about how wars begin. Auden writes, "Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives." He had a grim view of arrogant politicians. He thought little of the inattentive folk who ignored what's going on in their own country. And he had really no time for the ignorant of the games that the countries are playing. And then there is this stanza. Listen. "All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. At the heart of our human experience, that is the moral choice, to love one another or die, to care for one another or perish. And there's no question why many pulled this poem off the shelf after the tragedies of 9/11. And with another wave of COVID-19 breaking out among us, Auden's poem is both poignant and true. And beneath it all, it resonates with the familiar text we've heard from Matthew 25. In that text, Jesus lays out the vision of how God will judge the earth. And it comes at the end of a series of parables, so some regard it as a parable, a veiled story about the dominion of God, but it is more than a parable. It is a vision, a revelation of what is really going on and what is and what will be ultimately true. Now, most of us have heard it. We've heard it several times. So let me call attention to just a few details. First, there is a clear difference between people. In this vision, they are not color-coded as red, blue, or purple in between. No, they are split into two other groups. And there's no confusion about where people are, no blurring of the lines, no grading on the curve. We are either placed here or here, and we are not the ones who get to choose where we are. We are sorted by the king on the throne, and not just any king, the king who sits on the throne. Now, anybody who has read or listened to Matthew's gospel knows that this is coming. Way back in chapter 13, Matthew reports Jesus as declaring the kingdom of God is like a fishing net that catches every kind of fish. There are goldfish and guppies. There are stingrays and sharks. Every conceivable kind of fish in between. And they're all in the net. And when the net is full, says Jesus, it is pulled ashore. And the fish are sorted either as good or evil. It's a glimpse of what he now says again in this parable. Sheep on the right, goats on the left, nobody in the middle. Second thing about it, the determining factor, the basis of the sorting, is a single issue. And here it is. Did you care for others or not? Yes or no. There's no room for maybe, no room for apology, no room for stating good intentions. And again, this is no surprise for anybody in Matthew's either-or book, especially if they've been working through his lessons on discipleship. This is the book where Jesus blesses the meek of the earth. He chooses those who are blessed, the meek. And he says, if you give a cup of cold drinking water to the little ones, that is, the ones with the greatest needs, you will keep your reward. Now, since this book is written maybe 50 years after the resurrection, it sounds like old brother Matthew is confronting a lazy congregation. They have all the theology in their heads, but no love in their hearts. And as I said, this is the last teaching that Jesus offers before he dies. Matthew puts it at the end of the story to stress its importance, as if to say, if you forget everything else, don't forget this. This is the final exam for the course of human life. And there's one question on the exam. Did you care for others? Yes or no? And then the third detail, perhaps the most unusual, is that Jesus is hiding among the needy. The one who will judge us is standing in the bread line waiting for a scoop of food. The one who sits upon the governing throne at the center of the universe is now in the checkout line at the dollar store, wondering if he has enough pocket change to buy a single can of pork and beans. No one will recognize this incognito king. Not those on the right, not those on the left. It's just as well, because he doesn't want their preferential treatment. Nobody is able to say, "Well, Lord, if I knew it was actually you, I would have paid more attention." Nobody is allowed to offer a rebuttal for his sorting and said, "Well, if I had realized it was you, I would have shown you some care." Oh, no. Both sheep and goats ask the same question, "Lord, when did we see you?" Both get the same answer, "You didn't." And the point is not whether anybody recognizes Jesus or not. His hidden presence exposes the truth about us. Either we care or we don't. Either we love or we die. So let me ask you this. If you're taking a course and you have a final exam, and you know there's one question on the exam, and you know the question in advance, wouldn't you want to study up and prepare? I mean, the challenge here is to prepare for what is coming for all of us. And it does take some preparation. We're not naturally born with skills in how to love. We must be taught. We must be trained. We must be challenged. And you know as well as I that some folks are easy to love, and then there are the others. Some people will accept help and accept it graciously, and other folks are conditioned to say, "Oh no, I can do it, what's the word? Myself, I'll be okay." About a dozen years ago, we sent a few teams to clean up after Hurricane Katrina. We wanted to help. We didn't want to sit up here on high ground and dry land. We didn't want to say, "Well, isn't it too bad to see in the news what happened to those poor people?" So we went. One day, they sent a few of us over to Dena Drive. It's a suburban cul-de-sac. We started knocking on doors to assess if there was anything that we might do. One warm-hearted couple invited me in, offered me a cold drink, told me how the winds blew the roof off their house. They were okay, but the roof was gone. Fortunately, they had an emergency savings account, and when a roofing contractor with a big smile dropped by, they asked him to do the work. They emptied out their account to give him a deposit, and he never came back. That was 2 months before. The blue tarp was still on top of their house, and I sat there shocked, wondering, what could I say? What could I do to improve this situation? I listened. They wept. We prayed. Across the street was a single father named Jack. He worked as an engineer on an offshore oil rig. He and his 12-year-old son, Jack Jr., lived in a FEMA trailer parked in front of what was left of their house. He wanted nothing to do with our work crew. "No way," he said. "No offense," he said, "but a group like yours comes down here, they put up the drywall, they don't keep it straight, they don't tape it, they don't sand it, but they take selfies in front of it. And the next youth group comes, they paint it, they do a lousy job, and then both groups leave feeling pretty good about themselves. while I'm tearing out all the lousy work they did to do it right myself. All I could do was listen, let him unload for a few minutes, and let him know there was a fellow human being who heard the story. You know, it's hard work to care for other people, especially if you cannot fix their situation. Especially if there's little to do to take away the pain and the suffering. You know, the temptation, which is kind of a substitute for true caring, is to pretend you know how to fix everything. I mean, early in my ministry, maybe not so long ago, in my ceaseless desire to have people like me, I would make all kinds of promises. Let me get you a bag of groceries. Do you need some money? How about if I call you once a day at 2 o'clock? Is there something I can do? So on and so forth. And you can guess, or maybe you know, how those promises turned out, especially if you've ever made them about somebody you cared about. Let me offer a blanket apology to all the people I've let down. None of us can fix all the hurts and troubles of another human being. But here's what we can do. We can join them in their humanity. The word human becomes an adjective when it is humane. We can be present, completely present. We can hush up our own anxiety and listen. If we speak, we can offer open-ended questions such as, well, how are you today? Or what does it feel like to go what you're going through? To hush and let them tell us. Not to worry about being an expert or a fix-it person. Just settle in and be a human being. You know, I've taken courses and workshops in counseling over the years. I've spent time with counselors being counseled myself. And yet, the best training of all, I think, came from a professor in a worship class, of all things, that had nothing to do with counseling. We're all new at this caregiving thing, at least professionally. And a classmate asked, well, what do you do if somebody calls to tell you about a tragedy, a death or an accident or something bad? He looked over his spectacles and simply said, you go. But what if you don't know what to say? And he replied, you aren't there to speak. You are there to be there. It was subtle but brilliant advice, because he knew the alternative, the temptation, is to not go, to hold back, to stick to yourself, to choose isolation, to risk falling into indifference, to let your heart then grow cold and surrounded by thorns. Now, these are the days of COVID-19. The virus is real. It is not a joke. We must find ways to go without necessarily physically going. That might take a bit of imagination. Maybe it's going to involve a phone call or an email or reaching into that desk drawer full of greeting cards you haven't sent in a while. Or, and imagine this, maybe it involves writing a handwritten letter to someone. When was the last time you got something like that or sent something like that? But imagine the difference it might make. And so the vision of Christ the shepherd sorting the sheep and goats invites us to keep growing in our love, to cultivate sympathy, to develop skills in loving others in ways that empower them, not demean them. And one of the great truths about caring for others is that it is reciprocal. True caring is never from a position of power. I've got power, let me give you something. No, it's side by side. It's not towering over somebody, but by pulling up a chair. There's no need to fix something, especially something not easily fixed, but if you choose to be present, you can be present even from miles away. The other truth about caring is that it becomes the means by which the risen Christ reaches all of us. Two things we know presently about Jesus: he is alive and he is hidden. As we reach then sideways to one another, the mystery is that he reaches both of us. And sometimes we might even catch a glimpse of him at work. Now, this takes practice. All important things take practice. But the one thing I know in my bones is that if we extend love to one another, particularly those in need, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, we won't ever have to ask, "Lord, when did we see you?" We'll know. Oh, yes, we'll know.